Well, wait, no, is this not sex specifically? No, see, this is the cuts we made last year.
I'd like to call a meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order.
Yeah, exactly.
It appears as though we're 2 minutes late, but we're working on my watch. And it's precisely 12:30. At this time, I'd like to look for a motion for the approval of our minutes from our last meeting. So move. Any discussion? Any corrections? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Minutes approved. We'll continue with our overviews. Today, we're going to hear from the House of Higher Education. And several folks, I'm not sure who's first, but maybe they all come at once. And whoever is going to start, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Barb Schlaefer. I'm the acting director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. With me are Mark Michikanis, he's the director of finance and research, and Tricia Grimes, she's a policy analyst also with the agency. So with that, we'll get right to our overview of the agency, which we were asked to present. The Office of Higher Education became a cabinet-level agency in 2003. At the time, the governor and the legislature sought an independent agency and administrative-level voice for higher education that was not attached to a system or an institution in particular. Prior to this, it was the Higher Education Services Office, which appointed its own director. Our mission is to advance the promise of higher education to all Minnesotans and provide the critical information needed to make informed higher education decisions. We serve students all across the state in both public and private institutions. We regulate more than 150 institutions, and about 100 of those private institutions participate in state financial aid programs as well. The Office of Higher Education serves students in a variety of different ways, which we'll go over in great detail today. First, financial aid. The largest portion of our state appropriation by far goes to financial aid programs, scholarships, work study, and other aid. Second, consumer protection. We regulate both nonprofit and for-profit institutions in Minnesota. Third, we provide college access and information programs and services to families across the state. And finally, we do have a lot of data and analysis on higher education, and we're a place that you can go for all kinds of questions you may have about enrollment, financing of higher ed, and that sort of thing. We have 65 employees at the agency, and about 24 of those are state-funded. And with that, Mr. Michikanis is going to talk about some of our larger programs.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, again, for the record, Mark Michikanis with the Office of Higher Education. The pie chart that you have in front of you simply is a distribution of the general fund spending for fiscal 11, roughly about $1,359,000,000. The point here is to show you our share of that spending. Roughly 44% goes to the Minsky system, 45% roughly to the University of Minnesota, and the remaining 11% to our office. 93% of that remainder does go out in student aid and a number of programs that I'll go over in some in a minute here. We use about 2% of the total for state agency administration, essentially running the programs, doing our research, other things like that. And then there are some other state programs. So the largest in that 5% is the Minitex program, Minilink program. That's an appropriation that comes through our office from this committee, and that we work with the University of Minnesota on the services for that. The next chart then is kind of will be a summary of the state grant of the state programs, the aid programs that we administer through the office. The largest of which is the state grant program. For fiscal 11, the spending for that program was about $119 million. It was projected to be $119 million. And we do have a table later in the presentation that shows you some history of that over the last 10 or so years. So you'll be able to see how that has changed over time. We have a loan program that we operate through the agency. It's called the self-loan program. For the current fiscal year, we will issue to students about $90 million in loans. There is no direct general fund appropriation for this. It's all self-funded through tax-exempt or taxable bonds that we issue, and student repayments of loans. And again, I'll get into some detail about that program in a few minutes as well. And then we have a number of other financial aid programs that total roughly $29 million, the largest of which is the Minnesota Work Study Program at about $13.5 million for fiscal 11. Next largest is child care program at roughly $7 million. This goes to students that are attending post-secondary institutions that have child care needs. The tuition reciprocity program, which is an arrangement that's been in place for a number of decades between Minnesota, North, South Dakota, a couple schools in Iowa and Wisconsin. This year, there'll be a need of spending of roughly $4 million. And Mr. Chair, I believe that you might have received a letter on this in the last couple weeks about transferring money from one of our programs to another.
Yes.
This is for a payment to North Dakota. The Wisconsin arrangement actually provides money both directly to the state general fund as a non-dedicated revenue source and also to the University of Minnesota directly, too. That's a program that's in transition a bit on the Wisconsin side. But the reciprocity appropriation that you need to make for the payment to North Dakota is something that is very hard to estimate. And hence the need for us to transfer some money from another program to make that payment this fiscal year. We operate the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program. This was transferred to our agency from Department of Education a few years back, roughly $2 million. The Achieve Scholarship Program, something that's been in place for about 3 years. Spending for the current fiscal year is going to be about $1.2 million. Part of that's federal money, part of that's state money. And then a couple final ones, our college savings plan, the 529 plan, the legislature appropriates funds for that for grants to match for low-income families. However, the assets in this program exceed $600 million. So the assets in the savings plan, the 529 refers to the IRS code. They are significant as parents, grandparents, and others save for children, grandchildren's futures for post-secondary education. But the amount you see there is simply for the matching grant portion of that. And then the final program that we administer, but the appropriation for which does not go through your committee, Mr. Chair and members, is from Veterans Affairs for the GI Bill. We're good at doing scholarship work, so we do the administration of the program. But the direct appropriation for the program itself goes through Veterans Affairs.
We have a question, if I can interrupt, from Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michikanis, on the Achieve Scholarship Program, I know that's a state program. Where did you get matching money from the feds for that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rukavina, it's not matching money. The two federal programs, SLEEP and LEAP programs, that are actually part of the state grant program. So last year, as you recall, we kind of moving the money back and around between these programs. It was the federal money that we had targeted for the $1.2 million. That was kind of the understanding, I think, was that was the spending limit. So it simply is a question of how much federal money you use for this and how much state money. So it's really the $1.2 million that's the peg for spending.
Are you going to permanently put that federal money into the Achieve program? Is that a decision, or are you just doing it because we have that shortfall that you helped create?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. The sleep late money is typically part of the state grant program. Actually, in the base for 2012 and 2013 for Achieve, I think there's $2.3 million annually. So the intent is to leave those two programs with the state grant program.
And then finally,
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Schlafer, I've never seen you before, and I was just wondering, so are you a Dayton temporary appointee or a Palenque holdover temporary appointee?
Yes. I've been the acting director since the second week in December, so Governor Palenque appointed me around the second week of December when Dr. Metzen left, and then I was temporarily appointed January 3rd by Governor Dayton.
So, Mr. Chair, you've got thrust into a position you never had, but you've been there a while.
I've been in state government 20 years and at the agency for 6.
Okay, I'm just trying to get my bearings, I just want to know whether I got to be nice to you or otherwise. So.
We won't even wait for an answer. So.
Okay.
Okay, I guess you can resume.
Mr. Chair, members, let me continue with a little more detail about the state grant program itself. We have a pie chart for you to look at just to see how that fits into overall aid for students attending Minnesota institutions. Actually, Ms. Grimes does a survey every 2 years of institutions to try to determine how much aid students are receiving. Obviously, the state grant program goes through our agency. You're all aware, we'll be, after, I guess, after I have this conversation here with you, about federal need-based programs and grants, especially the Pell Grant program. But obviously, institutions themselves, private, public, University of Minnesota, and the nonprofits do provide a number of grants and scholarships for students. So in 2009, which was the last year of first survey, over $1 billion was provided for students for financial aid. You can see that roughly half of that, a bit more than half of that, was through institutional grants and scholarships, and that the state grant program makes up about roughly 14% of that total. So, Mr. Chair, let me just move through some of the details of the grant program itself. It's been in place for quite a while. It was created back in the late 60s. A significant modification to its current structure occurred in the early 80s. It is a need-based program, so it's driven by income of families. It was one of the main thrusts of the program is to give students choices about where they attend. In fact, there is a policy statement in the statute to that point that students are the best at determining where they should attend school. So the grant program does go to all public and most private schools in the state to the extent that they're eligible for the program. Finally, it's designed on a philosophy of what we call shared responsibility, but the idea is that students, families, and taxpayers all have a role to play in educating their students. Very quickly, and I can go through, we're going to go through some charts about how that actually plays out. Real quickly, just on eligibility, a student has to be a Minnesota resident and attending a Minnesota institution. They have to show satisfactory academic progress. Roughly what that means is they have to maintain about a 2.0 average and be towards completion in about 150% of the standard time or conventional time of a degree. They have to demonstrate financial need. By that, what that means is that the families have to fill out a FAFSA, free application for federal student aid. And if any of you have students in college and have gone through this process, you know what that's like. It's a bit of an unkind process, if you will. But it does need to be filled out in order for a student to qualify. The nice thing, I think an important aspect of this is that we use the same application process that the federal government uses, so we don't ask parents to fill out two different application forms. Everything is tied well together. And then there's a number of other, what I would refer to as minor eligibility requirements. Since this is an overview, not to get into too much of the details. Roughly, the grant program provides funds for more than 80,000 students annually. And again, you'll see a chart in a few minutes that indicates that that was significantly higher last fiscal year. The average grant amount is about $1,800 a year per student. And as I mentioned earlier, the application process is well coordinated with the federal Pell Grant. And roughly 70% of the recipients also receive a Pell Grant, so there's quite a bit of integration that goes on between the two programs. And just a final kind of a summary note is that about 85% of the dollars are awarded to students with families with incomes below $50,000. So, Mr. Chair, if I can just kind of go through how this thing is kind of built. Okay. The next chart.
Before you go on, yes. Can we stop for just one question? Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, do you keep track of the number of the students, the 80,000 students getting a grant? How many of those fulfill their four-year and get a degree? Do you have data to show how useful the money is, how it's being used? I know it's useful to the student getting it, but are we getting the outcomes through graduation?
Mr. Chair, let me kind of start the response, and I can turn over to Tricia Grimes. We did a persistence study a few years ago where we tried to match the state grant database with our enrollment database, and I think we got some of the answer. Unfortunately, we don't have good data on graduations by student.
Mr. Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. Yes, our indication is that the persistence of state grant recipients who attend full-time is roughly similar to that of students who do not receive a state grant. We do not have specific statistics on graduation of state grants at this time, but we are in the process of trying to develop a data system that would enable us to track that kind of information.
Sure, members, and if I can move on and try to build the state grant, I understand, because there's a number of important policy parameters that you'll all act on over the course of the next few months underlying the program itself. Of course, students attend college, pay tuition and fees of an arrangement based on where the school they attend, but for the purposes of the program, only a certain amount is recognized. And in the case that you see before you, there's a recognition of $10,488. That's for four-year programs. Students in two-year programs have a lower amount than that, but that's kind of the starting point, is tuition and fees. To that number is added a living and miscellaneous expense amount. That current number for that is $7,000. We've done some analysis of that amount. That's what you recognize for the program. Obviously, on tuition and fees, we report that data we accumulated from the institutions. The LME is a little bit more difficult because it's hard to tell how much students are actually paying out in expenses. We've done some analysis just recently of with consumer expenditure survey data. That's data that's used by the Bureau of Labor Statistics to put together the consumer price index. There's lots of expenditure data in there. We can kind of break it down by students. And this is a national number, not a Minnesota number, but I think it's fairly accurate for these purposes. The number is around $12,000 is what students pay for living expenses annually. So you can see by comparison how that works itself out. So then once that recognized price is established, that becomes the starting point for who pays. As I recall, I said the students' families and the taxpayer share in this responsibility. So the first dollar goes to the student, and that's what you see in this orange set of bars. The current percentage, this is based on a percentage, not a fixed dollar amount. So the higher the tuition and fees for a student, the more that student would be expected to pay towards that education. The current percentage is 48.2%. It's higher than it has been in the past, because last year we had a ration of state grant appropriation. 46% was the rate prior to that, and had been for a couple of years. So this becomes the first dollar towards that the total price of attendance. The second piece then is the family responsibility. A couple points about this. You can see that families that are roughly $30,000 above are expected to contribute towards their child's education. Anything below that, there is no expectation from the family. And you can see that increases as the family's income increases. If you could connect those bars, there's a slope of a line there. That, again, is something that you have policy influence over. Fundamentally, it comes from the FAFSA application, but there are some ratios in statute that adjust that a bit for independent students. And this is something that we have talked about over the last couple of years, is the slope of that line. The next step then is the taxpayer's share, and the federal Pell is the first dollar in the taxpayer's share. That's indicated by the green, and that tends to go to lower income students, as you can see from the chart. And then the state grant fills in. So the taxpayer's share is made up of two parts, the federal Pell grant and the state grant. And you can see how the cost of attendance is allocated, if you will, to all the parties involved. This is a very well-integrated program between the federal government and state government. It's something that, as I've observed public programs over the course of time, is not always the case. I think this is one that's very well-integrated and serves the students well.
We have a question again from Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michikanis, last year you were projecting about a $40 million hole in the state grant program because of the pressure put on it. And then I believe the House gave back, I don't know if it was some work study money or child care money or whatever, we got reduced to about $36 million, right? The projection was?
Changes in parameters.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, at the end of the day, I think there was a bit of child care or work study money.
Yeah. But in any event, it brought that projection down. So how close were you to projections when you prorated in? Was it 36 million? Was it more? Was it less? Do you know?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we do have a slide from here that I could refer to, and you'll see the exact numbers as we move between fiscal 10 and fiscal 11.
Well, before we get to this, I got an attention deficit disorder, so okay. Before we get there, why don't you tell me how close you were and where that money goes then, if you withheld more than you needed.
Mr. Chair and members, if you recall, the conversation was we wanted to cover some uncertainty at the end of the last session. Because of the strong increase in enrollments fall a year ago, we weren't quite sure, so there was some debate about holding back, I think it was $10 million. The way it happened is we had the appropriation, we had to go into fiscal 11, we had a ration, the grant payment, and we wanted to leave something there for changes for this fiscal year.
Which we had an argument about, Mr. Chair, you may remember.
There was a good discussion about that, yes, Mr. Chair, what happened then is we set some money aside, and based on this year's enrollments, we actually increased the LME by $274. So,
did you return all the money you withheld then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rupina, yes.
Including that cushion that
yes.
you wanted to keep?
Yes.
Good job, Mr. Gannis. That's okay. Good for you.
Mr.
Mr. Chair, and then members, so this kind of completes the process. Again, this is the allocation of the recognized price under the program. Obviously, students' families face different amounts based on their particular circumstances. If I can move it then, Mr. Chair, this is simply a chart that shows how these program parameters have changed going back to the year 2000. You can see the living and miscellaneous expense account expense allowance has gone from about not quite $5,100 up to the $7,000 I indicated. You can see how the assigned student responsibility has changed over time. The tuition maximums, both for the two-year programs, which I mentioned, are different and lower than the four-year programs. And then on the final right-hand side is the federal Pell Maximum Award. So this gives you a sense of what these are in relationship to each other. Again, these are all important policy parameters that you establish within this committee. I'm sorry, except for the Pell Award that's established by the federal government.
We have a question, Senator Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about multiple students, multiple children. Is there any formula that allows for if you have two or three or four children that assists you so that your income is the same, but you've got more children involved in higher ed?
Chair, Representative Poppy, again, I'll start the answer, and perhaps Ms. Grimes can respond if I don't get it totally right. It's really taken into account in the federal needs analysis, the FAFSA. That's based on your income and other assets, an amount is determined if you have one child attending college, but if you have more than one, then that's adjusted dramatically down, so you're expected to contribute less for each child.
Ms. Grimes?
Mr. Chair, basically what they do, the federal government calls it the expected family contribution, and they compute that based on the family size and the family income. And if there's two children in college at one time, they simply split that existing family contribution in two. Now, in Minnesota, we call it, as part of the state grant calculation, we call it the assigned family responsibility because it's not exactly a contribution. And it's an arbitrary amount that's actually assigned to the family. But it's the same concept.
Okay. Any further questions, Representative Poppe?
I'll continue. The chart you have in front of you now is state grant spending, going back to the year fiscal year 2000 and ending up with the projected number that $119 million that I indicated earlier. And perhaps it's maybe most important to talk about the last 2 years because of the dramatic change, especially for the new members on the committee. The appropriation for the state grant program is about roughly $144 million annually. We came into fiscal 2010 with that appropriation, but as I mentioned earlier, enrollments probably due mostly to the economy and economic downturn spiked dramatically well beyond anything that we had anticipated the prior spring when the appropriation was set. So we ended up going from about 84,000 recipients up to the number you see there, 103,544. A dramatic increase in the number of recipients. This drove spending on the program up dramatically as well to the $168 million figure you see there. We struggled internally fall a year ago with the notion that should we ration grants to students that were attending in fiscal 2010, which we are allowed to or authorized to do under law, or should we award those full of grants and then use the rationing in 2011. We had conversations, I think, with staff and members here along those issues as well. And the thought was is that students and families had made decisions for fiscal 10, that school year, based on an expectation of a grant amount, so that we should award that amount. And then going into the current academic year, current fiscal year, that we would ration in order to make sure that the spending fit the appropriation. But students and families would know that amount before they made decisions for going to college. So that's why the dramatic change from the $168 million to the $119 is the fact that we had to ration the grant amount for families in order to make the spending fit the appropriation. Moving on then, Mr. Chair and members. Let me move to the self...
They have it in the handout.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, you have a handout apparently did show up on the presentation that simply shows recipients, number of recipients by income class or income levels. Obviously, there's many more of those in low-income levels. The bars show the numbers, and then the curve is the cumulative amount or cumulative percentage over income. So clearly, based on the structure of the program, the number of recipients drops as income increases. And just to point out that the last bar appears to be a bit higher than the second to last bar, but that's because that's four families of $70,000 of income or more, so it really is inclusive of a much larger group of people than just those that would fall within those $10,000 categories. I'm sure then, and members, let me discuss the self-loan program quickly to you. Again, this is a program that's been in law since the early 80s, a very successful program, roughly in the range of 20,000 borrowers annually, as I mentioned earlier, about $90 million in loan proceeds. As I mentioned, there's no direct general fund appropriation. What the agency does is sells or issues either taxable or tax-exempt bonds, to the extent that we have tax-exempt authority. Sell them to the bond market and take those proceeds, lend the amounts out to students, and then the bonds are repaid as students repay the loans. Again, it's been a successful program, I think, because of the fact that it's been in place for quite a while, going back to the early 80s. To me, that's always a sign of something that's working, is that it's in place. We have two kinds of loans that we issue to students. You see a fixed rate loan there of 7.25%. That is very new. We just started doing that last fall. We just completed a bond issue of $55 million in December. I think it was extremely well received by the financial markets. We spent a lot of time talking to rating agencies, bond counsel, underwriters, people that are all involved in this process. We have Springsteen as our bond or our financial advisor. We went to a fixed rate program because we wanted to respond to the market. A number of students and families are a bit more wary of variable rate mark loans in any form, whether it's housing mortgages or car loans and the like. And a number of other providers were going to a fixed rate program, so we thought we needed to do this. But the other loan product, if you will, that we have in place is a variable rate product. Current rate on that is 3.8%, which is extremely low. This has been the one that we've used over the course of time. As I mentioned, families tend to be a bit more reluctant to take this out because of the variable nature of it, but at the same time, because it's such a low rate, there is still a substantial demand for it.
We have a question, if I can interrupt for just a moment. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Miscanos, what do you do with the money you make? I know you pay the bondholders, but at 7.25, even 3.8, you're making money.
Mr. Chair, yes, we are, and it goes back into the equity of the program and is redistributed out. Simply for cash flow purposes, sometimes we don't have the funds available that we would need in order to meet demand. So it goes right back into the equity of the program. This is a significant program. The gross assets of the program are nearly $1 billion. The net assets are somewhere in the range of $350 million.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. McGinnis, why not do more of it? It's a very popular program. You capped it at 10 grand. You've got a low default rate. Why $55
million?
Mr. McGinnis?
Chair and members, the $55 million was established simply because we weren't sure. It was a new program at the fixed rate. We weren't sure what the demand for it was going to be. And actually, for this year, that was our available tax exempt bond authority. I should mention to the members is that this is a bit of a contentious point. Is there's a limited amount of tax exempt authority in the state for these kinds of programs. Housing is another user of these things, industrial development bonds. So our agency gets about $10 million initially in January, another $10 million typically in the fall. And we've dealt quite a bit with housing finance. We now have the authority to transfer between agencies. That was new last year.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Conis, even
Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recognize that the tax exempt authority is capped. Everybody's got to take their own share of that. But even as a revenue bond, what rates are you getting on the revenue bond versus the tax exempt bond?
Mr. Conis,
Mr. Chairman, actually they're both revenue bonds, but. Maybe a better way to respond is if we had tax completely tax exempt authority, what would be the difference for students? Would they?
Mr. Chair,
that's the question you're asking.
No, okay. The question is, what are you selling them to bondholders at, and what are we? You've represented what the rate is. I'm
sure.
Curious what the bondholders are making, and whether there's, you know, arbitrage is no longer a nice word, I guess, but. I'm just curious if this isn't a potential revenue generator for the state. If it's such a popular program, you can borrow more money. You can pay the bondholders, I assume, at a relatively modest rate compared to what you're lending it at.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, the $55 million, maybe that's because it's fresh in my mind, is the best way to describe this, is you know, you structure a bond deal, you settle over a period of time, but if you have to come up with a true interest cost, it was about 4.65%. That was the cost of our funds. To that amount, we have to add a margin that covers the cost of the servicer, things like that. So I think we, at the 7.25%, we were just about there when you add all, kind of the all-in cost. On the 3.8%, it's the same thing. There's a cost of funds that changes quarterly. It's tied to the LIBOR rate, if people are familiar with that. And then again, we have to add a margin for our servicer costs, things like that. And the current margin is 3.5%. 3.5% on that. Because the cost of funds is so cheap, it's about 30 basis points.
Just a final point, Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Atkins.
And then I'll be quiet. Could you send me more information, Mr. Miskonis? It strikes me that the margin there between 4.6 and 7.25. Well, just send me more information. It strikes me as a very significant margin to pay for your, I assume it's administrative, legal, and finance costs of those funds. I'm just curious if there's not some additional money there that could be made, or the rate perhaps could even be lower. Yeah. It seems like a very wide margin.
Mr. Chair, maybe just 2 points to that. We try to manage our margin on the variable side so as not to create surprises for students. And I think that's important. So to the extent that costs may drop, we have the authority to change the margin itself. Cost of funds is fixed by the market, but we can change the margin. And it may be that sometimes we could reduce the margin by another 25 basis points, but we think it might go up later on. So in order to keep payments to students fairly constant, we try to manage that in a sensible way. One other aspect, just on the money side and the asset side, is that there are some limitations in the indenture, bond indenture. as far as what we can do with some of the funds. So, but we will get you more information.
Thank you.
We have another question, I believe, from Representative Morrow as well.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins touched on much of what I wanted to ask, so I just have a specific factual question. Are people really borrowing at a fixed rate of 7.25%? Are people using it?
Mr. Chair and members, as we unveiled this program, we actually were issuing bonds last fall before we had done our bond deal. And the demand, if you will, coming into the agency was about half and half. Okay. About half the, was went on fixed rate, about half went on the variable rate.
All right, go ahead.
And then let me just finish with the default rate, because that's important. That's in the news quite a bit at the national level. What you see, there's a default rate of 4.6%, but you can calculate default rates in many different ways. The number you have in front of you is, if you look back over the last 20 years, take the total aggregate of the bonds that we have sold, which is, the loans we've issued, which is about $1.8 billion for students in the state, and you look at the initial default rates, you know, did a default occur according to the promissory note, the rate's at about 4.6%. But we have a number of different ways to recover those funds, including the fact that a cosigner has to be on the loan to begin with. So after all those collections are factored in, the default rate's about 1.8%.
I have a quick question on that self-loan, not having anyone in college anymore, but do students start paying that loan back while they're in school, or is it deferred till later?
Mr. Chair, students have to pay back as they're in school. It's so just the interest that's due, but that's one thing that the rating agencies find very favorable, is the fact that students are become accustomed to paying debt back because they're obligated to pay it back.
But it's only interest until they graduate.
Yes, until they graduate.
Representative Bannon.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Miskin, or any of you, I think it answers. When I was campaigning, some of my students would talk to me. I teach at St. Cloud State, and some of my students would talk to me about the self-loan as being an opportunity they receive after they've received the rest of their financial aid that somehow isn't integrated, and that it sometimes has led to a little confusion for them in terms of what's the optimal package of financial aid they should get. Can you address that for me, please?
Mr. Chairman, Tricia Grimes, basically the way it works is, by and large, students take federal Stafford direct loans first. They tend to have low interest rates in general, particularly if it's what's called a subsidized loan, because the family is lower income or lower middle income. I believe that interest rate this year is 4%, and then they take a federal Stafford unsubsidized loan if they need more money and they're not eligible for the subsidized loan, and the interest rate on that one is 6.8%. But starting in February of 2010, the federal government changed rules about student loans that were part of overall credit reform, and they basically said that campuses are not allowed to include self-loans in the package, in the financial aid award letter that goes out to the student. They are allowed to include federal plus loans, which is a parent loan, which is at 7.9%, but they are not allowed to include in that financial aid award letter the self loan. And that is something that we are actually talking to our congressional delegation about, because there are a number of cases in which the self loan would be a better deal for the student and the family. The other problem with federal plus loans is that the parent is the borrower. And there are parents who don't want to be the borrower. They don't mind being a co-signer, but they want the student to be the borrower. And the self-loan allows the student to be the borrower, but the federal plus loan does not. The federal government has basically taken the attitude that they don't know much about the Minnesota self-loan, frankly, and that federal loans must be better than private bank loans. And they sort of, the fact that there are some state loan programs, kind of, they know they exist, but they really haven't paid much attention to it thus far.
Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to help you get that message across, because there are students in the St. Cloud State community, at least that I know of, who would like to have the opportunity to have that opportunity integrated into their loan package as they consider how to finance their college education. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, and let me proceed on just a single chart, if you will, on consumer protection. The agency is involved with ongoing regulation of institutions that offer programs in the state. We regulate or license all the not-for-profit and the for-profit institutions that are located both within Minnesota and outside Minnesota. And we also regulate public institutions that are outside Minnesota that do offer programs in the state. This actually is something that is only of a growing concern because of online learning. A number of other public institutions outside the state do offer programs online for obvious reasons to students that are in the state. And for our purposes, we only can regulate them if we know they're operating. It's pretty hard to know that unless we actually see that, although there's been a recent change at the federal level that's going to require all institutions to register within the state where they operate. And we've gotten a number of inquiries the last few weeks just on that point. What I mean by when I use the word regulation, again, this is something that is a policy matter that you deal with. But there's two kind of major points to this. Every 5 years or so, we review course catalogs and faculty lists to make sure that they do meet the certain standards. We also require institutions to file annual financial statements with us. We do review those to make sure that they remain financially viable. The second part of this regulatory or consumer protection aspect is that we approve all programs and degrees that are offered by private institutions. We do this through outside consultants that actually know how programs should be operated at a higher education institution. But before anyone can be offered, they have to go through our agency and get those approved. Another important aspect of our consumer protection responsibility is to assist students in recovering fees when something has gone wrong. This, of course, happens from time to time, but typically takes a phone call to an institution and say, what's going on? Let's straighten things out. And things typically work out pretty well for students. As I mentioned, we do evaluate financial viability because we want to make sure that institutions will be in place for students to attend and to complete the course that they started with. And then finally, as part of this, we conduct audits of both public and private institutions to make sure that the financial aid that you enact into law and appropriate funds for, that those funds are being used to the extent that they're intended. With that, Mr.
Before we continue, we have a question or two. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Miskanis. You know, when I watch TV, I get these ideas that, you know, if the lawyer-legislator thing doesn't work out for me so well, I can become like a bartending video game designer or something. And I when I see those from the for-profits, the private for-profits, what percentage of that? You just got done talking about the loan program, the state grant program. What percentage goes to students who are attending the for-profits and want to be bartenders and video game designers?
Mr. Misakonis?
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, I don't have the number offhand unless Tricia does, but I can tell you that when we go to the bond sale, there are limitations on the amounts of those proceeds that can be lent to students in for-profit schools.
Ms. Grimes?
Mr. Chair, actually, the bartending school does not participate in state financial aid programs. It is licensed with us, but it does not participate in state financial aid programs. But we can get you the detail on the percentage of self-loans and Minnesota State grant by sector. We can provide that.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Atkins.
Thank you. It's somewhat of a loaded question because my second question then is, what's the default rate for those for-profits? Because the last I heard, it was enormously higher. I mean, not 2 or 3 percentage points higher than the St. Thomas and St. Catharines and the University of Minnesota's and Inver Hills and St. Clouds. But in the 40s, 43, 44, 45%, is that somebody fudging those numbers, or is it really dramatically higher, like they say?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, let me try to untangle that, and it may take me just a little bit here. The default rate that the federal government calculates is a 2-year default rate. It's the students who were supposed to start repaying their loans 1 year and didn't repay them either that year or the next year. And nationally, the default rate for for-profit institutions is 11.6%, whereas for all institutions, it's 7%. However, in Minnesota, the default rate, federal cohort default rate on federal loans for Minnesota students is, I'm trying to remember, 3.7%, I believe. For the for-profits in Minnesota, it's 5.8%. So it's about half the national average. And actually, the default rate at public two-year institutions, the community and technical colleges at Minsky, is 6.7% or thereabouts. Now, the 43% you heard about comes from a new federal proposed rule called on something called gainful employment, where they would come up with a new calculation that would calculate the percent of borrowers repaying principal. But they're kind of changing rules midstream in this regard. It is perfectly legal right now for students to get deferments for unemployment or economic hardship, to ask for a forbearance from the lender, or to enter into a repayment plan where they're paying interest only for a number of years. None of those students who are doing something perfectly legal would then be counted as repaying because they're not repaying principal. And so there have been some estimates that some of the for-profit programs may have 43% of their students that are not repaying principal.
So my real point or my real question, Mr. Chair, is relative to when you list the items that fall under consumer protection, does the office feel that you have a consumer protection role relative to the student who signs up for the video game design program at some for-profit school? At a cost of $27,000 per year or $33,000 per year, some outrageous amount of money, when the likelihood of getting a job in that field, you know, they graduate 200 and maybe three will get jobs in that field. Is there any, or is that beyond what your scope is? My concern is, and I know some of these young people that are getting, you know, kind of intrigued, pulled into these programs, they get $100,000 in loans, only to get out and get a job that pays $9 an hour. And as a parent of some kids who are about to head off to college myself, and I don't think they're going to make that choice, but you know, I'm wondering if that falls within the spectrum of what you're talking about here.
Mr. Representative Atkins, I think it's beyond the scope of the authority that you've given us as an agency. I think it's a very good question, though. It's a hard one to answer. Again, with the state grant program, the legislative intent that you've put in place is that students can choose those schools for those programs that best fit their needs. And certainly there's a limitation on the obligation of the state. You cap the amount that students can get. The $10,000 that I mentioned earlier as a limitation on the loan program is for four-year programs. So it doesn't apply at all. Again, that's another policy lever that you have. But certainly students are leaving school with a lot of debt. There's no question about that from a number of different programs. Tricia Grimes, I think, mentioned some of the changes, discussions at the federal level on an idea called gainful employment that's been quite a bit in the press the last 6 to 8 months, and it is targeted at for-profit schools. And the question is, are students leaving these institutions with the wherewithal, you know, to make a living that, or not to make a living, to be able to repay those loans? That's the notion of gainful employment. But I'll be honest with you, the conversation has come up too, if just them, why not everybody? It's a hard one.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Miscanis, I'd be fine with that. You cited the default rate at the two-year college is 6.5%. Isn't the word reasonable ever going to be employed I don't want to put you folks on the spot and ask you, would you like that authority? But for heaven's sakes, I mean, at some point, somebody's got to step up and make some reasonable economic decisions. And if the students won't make those decisions themselves, somebody has to exercise. This is, you know, public tax dollars that are going to help pay for it. And if they're all being gobbled up so that some kid can make 7.25 an hour when their degree doesn't pay off, and something that they should have known 4 years before they started the program or 2 years before they started the program, somebody's got to step up and say it's time to be responsible.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm Representative Atkins has kind of hit the nail on the head. I've spent the summer doing quite a bit of research in this particular area, in particular the for-profits, and you're right, it has come up federally. And I've read quite a bit about it. I guess I don't know how much oversight we can do as a committee, what things we could put in place, but the two words that I wrote down after having listened to everything Representative Atkins said, much of which I was going to say, is counseling and oversight. And I only bring this up now because you have consumer protection, and there are certain consumer protections that you do, but we have students, again, we have for-profit programs. I have a member of my own family that's dealt with this who was accepted into a program quite costly, took out loans, and then they were removed from the program midway through the year. Well, you know, now we have not an end program and a huge debt, and we have to start all over at the University of Minnesota, and so now we're going to go through, you know, I hate to even think what the end of the line loans are going to be for this young lady. But I think students need counseling. We assume, and it would be nice if all parents understood finances enough to give their children wise advice, and frankly, I think this body and the public in general, with the push for making sure everyone has a college education, is sometimes doing our children a disservice by saying you need an education at all cost. And frankly, at all cost is not the case. Having $50,000, $60,000 in student loans when you are getting a job that barely pays a living wage is not good advice. And so, you know, as we have control over that, and as you have control over that, students need more counseling and input. They need more limitations and oversight as to what they're getting themselves into. Despite these, you know, the defaults, maybe they are paying them off, but I know some folks who are grown adults who are still paying off student loans from 30 years ago, and they're still paying interest, not principal, because of the deferments that they get for things during their life. And you shouldn't be paying on the same $30,000 student loans for 40 years.
We have one more question, I believe, at this time. Representative Morrow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins, Mr. Berg and I were just talking about an article that I'm looking at right now in the New York Times of January 8th, I believe, here. Is law school a losing game? And the same questions are being raised here of the number of people with $250,000 debt working at Applebee's type of thing, and the way that law schools are counting gainful employment after 9 months. Mr. Chair, I think it's an interesting question that this committee needs to take a look at what counts as employment statistics and how do schools count employment, especially as we're talking about some of the loan programs. And we could talk, Representative Atkins, later about whether video game design or being an attorney would be the better career move at this point.
I think we both know the answer. Video game design.
It would seem to me this is sort of self-correcting, because the for-profits are at some point going to have to discontinue offering that program if their students are not going to be getting employment.
Mr. Chair, not at all. Not at all. In fact, if anything, they are encouraged to put on the hard sell. When you walk through my door, if I'm, let's not just call it the for-profits, but I want you to enroll because I want your loan money is what I want. Whether you then go belly up on me or not, it doesn't matter, because you owe the money off to the feds, or you owe the SELF program, you owe Mr. Misconis, I suppose, and his bondholders some money. But I got paid.
Yeah, I understand.
So somebody's just got to say no sometimes, you know?
Well, we need to get back on track here. And is Ms. Grimes, are you still the presenter of choice?
Sure.
Okay, you're not.
Mr. Chair, Member Mark Schlafer again.
Schlafer, yes.
The next area, and this is a short one, is college access and information. We have a couple of federal programs as well as some state programs and some directive in statute that we're supposed to inform students and families about both their college options and financial aid. And we do this in a few different ways. One is the a Get Ready program, which receives federal money from the Federal Gear Up program. And it serves about 9,000 students each year in schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul, as well as in greater Minnesota. The next one is the Intervention for College Attendance program, and that's a state-funded program. It's a competitive grant program, and the programs that are funded are statewide, and programs submit proposals and are selected by an independent body. Third is a new federal grant that we receive, a federal College Access Challenge grant. We just received that recently, and it's been put to use supporting the Naviance program and a variety of other college preparation programs around the state. And finally, the agency offers financial aid training and presentations, publications, websites, and other outreach with some state funding that we receive. The next slide shows
We do provide training to financial aid staff throughout the state, as well as to high school counselors each year about the complicated process of financial aid so that they can in turn help families and students that they serve. We fulfill requests from schools across the state, and we also go out and give presentations about financial aid to anybody who asks. And we have a website dedicated just to students and families.
Mr. Chair, the office is where people go to get comprehensive Minnesota data relating to higher education. We maintain the state's enrollment database for public and private institutions. We gather and analyze information on trends nationally, internationally, and in Minnesota, and we produce many reports. What follows are a few slides showing the kinds of data we collect, but know that these are just a few samples, the tip of the iceberg. If you have questions about higher education in Minnesota, chances are we can answer them for you. This slide is on undergraduate enrollment. You can see that the top line is the public, community, and technical colleges. And enrollment has increased substantially since 2000 in those schools. Then the next three lines, state universities, the University of Minnesota, and private colleges all enroll between 40 and 60,000 students. And this enrollment is a measure of enrollment we call the fall head count, counting the number of students enrolled in the fall each year. And enrollment has grown modestly at those three sectors over the last 10 years. The private career schools enrollment has been growing substantially. And then the one that's labeled private career online schools, those are undergraduates enrolled at Capella University, Walden University, University of Phoenix. And they have a larger enrollment of graduate students, and many of their students are not Minnesota residents, but Capella and Walden happen to be headquartered here.
Mr. Chair, I'll just take the next chart real quickly. This shows you as a committee, higher education spending is the share of the state general fund spending. Goes way back to the late 60s. I think you had a table from Mr. Berg the other day, that numerical table that showed you some of the percentages themselves. But again, this is the context within which you operate. Just a couple points on this. Since the late 80s, the share for higher education has been dropping. This is not unique to Minnesota. This is true in most of the other states across the country as we've made those kind of comparisons. And this is the kind of chart that kind of begs additional questions, many of them actually. If there's fewer students enrolled, then maybe a drop in share makes some sense. Clearly, there's been priorities placed by the legislature, K-12 funding, health funding, public safety, and the like, that tends to draw off funding from higher education. We're working on additional data that we'd be more than happy to share with the committee on looking at real spending over time, real spending per student over time, so you get a better picture of that as well.
Mr. Chair, slide 34 is about tuition and fees at Minnesota post-secondary institutions. And this is published tuition and fees. It's not a great analogy, but I'm going to use it. There is a difference between the sticker price and the net price that students pay after their grants and scholarships, and we'll be talking about that a little bit more in the next slide. But this just shows you what the published tuition and fees are currently at private nonprofit colleges. It's $30,400. At the University of Minnesota, it's nearly $12,300. State University, $6,900. And public two-year colleges, $4,900. And you can see that the published tuition price has, in fact, been increasing substantially over the last 10 years.
We have a question, if I can interrupt for a moment, to Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To any of the presenters today, I apologize for a little late for the question, but moving back to the slide where it shows the fall headcount over the last 10 years, anybody else on the committee and certainly for myself, I'm interested in projections for timelines for the next 10, though. I know Minsku, their population served is an average age of 26. Moving down state universities, University of Minnesota, those lines are more traditional in population, and what those might look like if you projected those out. My understanding is, at least in the upper Midwest, that those numbers, we've maybe reached our peak and will now continue to go down for the next 10 years. Yes, no?
Mr. Chair, there are a number of different currents that kind of are all operating simultaneously that make it rather difficult to project exactly where enrollment is going to go. By and large, students don't go back to college in large numbers after they're 40. Some do, but in terms of large numbers, they don't. And all of the baby boomers are now over 40. And so that sort of the natural population, we're starting to get into that trough between the baby boom and the next generation. On the other hand, the number of high school graduates is kind of stabilized right now and will be declining slightly in Minnesota over the next few years, but it's just like 1 or 2% a year. So there won't be an increased population of high school graduates. There is, within the high school graduate population, the percentage of students who come from low-income families or those where no one in the family has gone to college before is increasing. And if those students don't start enrolling in college at higher rates, enrollment could drop because of that. Meanwhile, the economy is sending all kinds of signals that some post-secondary education, whether it be a short-term certificate program, a two-year degree, a four-year degree, or a graduate degree, is necessary to survive in the economy. And so exactly how all of those different factors will play out as future enrollment is not yet clear.
Thank you. Mr. Benson?
That's good. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Grimes?
Okay. Slide 35 is talks about average and published and net tuition and fees. Now, this is actually a look back a couple of years because that way we were able to get averages for the difference between the published price and the net price. So you can see the public four-year institutions, and this would be the University of Minnesota and state universities taken together as a group. The published price is $7,797, but the average net price after scholarships and grants are subtracted is $5,467. And that difference would come from state grants, Pell grants, and at the University of Minnesota in particular, donated funds that have been contributed by alumni, for example. The biggest difference between the published and the net price is that the private not-for-profit four-year colleges and universities, where you can see the $23,000 published price, and this is just the tuition, mind you. This is not room and board and everything. The difference between the $23,000 and the $13,000. And nearly all of that is, or the biggest portion of that, is from institution scholarships and grants. Again, much of that coming from donated money. And I'm not going to talk about every number on this chart, but I'll just take you over to the public two-year schools, where the difference between the $4,603 published price and the $2,675, nearly all of that difference would be Pell grants and state grants, because there's very little donated scholarship money to students in that sector. And then this slide shows how net price varies across income. This assumes a family of four with one in college. And it includes $12,000 on top of the tuition and fees, the $12,000 being for room and board, books, transportation, and other expenses of being enrolled. And so you can see how the net price is somewhat lower at lower incomes. And it varies by sector. The blue at the bottom of that chart, the lighter blue is the enrollment of full-time students, and the darker blue is the enrollment of part-time students, to just give you kind of a sense of how many students are in those categories.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
One quick question. What's the anomalous? You have a slight dip there on the green line at the about the $80,000 mark. The actual price, the net price decreases.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I was afraid somebody was going to ask me that question. The number of schools...
I'll withdraw it, Mr. Chair. I'm so sorry.
Ms. Grimes.
There is some variation in what schools are reporting data that can kind of cause what we call noise in statistics from time to time. I believe there was an enrollment bump, but I'm going to have to get back to you on that. I'm not remembering exactly what that particular dip was about. On graduation rates, this is a look at students who graduated in 4, 5, or 6 years from what's supposed to be a four-year program. Six-year graduation rates at Minnesota four-year colleges and universities were 63% at the University of Minnesota, 48% at Minnesota State Universities, and 72% at private colleges and universities. And this is calculated as the number of full-time, first-time students who started in 2003 and completed a bachelor's degree at the same institution by 2009. If you track, many students transfer from one institution to another. And if you track students to wherever they transfer nationally, studies indicate that you pick up about 10% additional students who complete a bachelor's degree. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. Here you can see changes in the graduation rates over time in all three of the sectors shown here. They are increasing. The University of Minnesota has put a particular emphasis on increasing their six-year graduation rate. That kind of gives you an idea of what's happening with the graduation rates.
Representative Banyan.
Extremely quick question. For the Minscu institutions, if you transfer within Minscu, are you going to get picked up as still graduating within 6 years, or if you transfer between Minscu institutions, do you not get counted?
Mr. Chair, Minscu, I believe, does track some of that information, but this particular statistic is just based on whether you start and finish at the same school. In Minnesota, a national report by Georgetown University called Help Wanted indicates that 70% of job openings are projected to require some post-secondary education by 2018, from all the way from a short-term certificate to an associate or bachelor's degree or more. And just sort of looking at how Minnesota measures up to that potential benchmark, among 25 to 34-year-olds, 48% currently have earned an associate degree or higher, which ranks Minnesota third in the country, but is still substantially less than that 70% it's estimated that we would need. When it comes to just looking at those with a bachelor's degree or higher, 35% of Minnesotans are in that category in this age group, and that ranks Minnesota eighth in the country.
So, Mr. Chair and members, our last slide is just, we took the liberty of listing some challenges and opportunities for higher ed and maintaining a competitive workforce, and the first is improving college readiness, which we all know is largely a K-12 issue. 70% of high school graduates take the ACT, and 70% of high school graduates go on to post-secondary in some form, and those are both really strong, positive statistics, but as they get into post-secondary, the data suggests that too many of them weren't prepared, weren't ready, and so increasingly higher education is getting more and more involved in issues of K-12, the P-20 partnership, that kind of thing. So that's one challenge. Another is just the dramatically changing demographics, improving post-secondary productivity, and largely that's graduation rates, completion, and then integrating this whole challenge of online education. It's a great opportunity, but it's also a big challenge as well. Re-engaging adult learners. About 45% of those enrollment numbers that you saw, the headcount enrollment, 45% are students who are 25 or older. So that's a big group. And if we can successfully, the state that successfully can engage adult learners and help them sharpen their skills and continue to stay focused on education, and is going to be more competitive than those that don't. And then finally, the big one is maximize student access, choice, and success with limited state resources. Thank you for your time.
We have a question. Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I meant to ask this last week when there are the Minsky presenters, but I'm also sensitive to the fact with the population they serve, there's a lot of folks like me who went back after a while and got their degrees. But I'm really interested in finding out whether the statistics are available for college readiness for the traditional K through 12 when they graduate, the percent that need to go on and take remedial, and I'm very, very interested in finding that out. I didn't ask the Minscu folks while they're here. Again, like I'm sensitive to, they have 40-year-olds going back to school, and if you haven't been in a math class for 20 years, you're gonna need something. But K through 12. What are we looking at? So if you don't have those with you, I'd sure like to get those numbers.
Mr. Chair, we do have, there's a report that the University of Minnesota and Minscu prepare every 2 years called Getting Prepared, and it's not for students who are 30 or 40 going back to school. It's just for those who come right out of K-12, and it suggests, I think, 37% of students coming straight from public K-12 high schools 37% require some developmental courses, so they need some preparation before they can get into credit-bearing courses. But we can get you the full report. Is that what you were asking?
Yep. I guess the other thing that I would like to ask is that information stratified so that we can say we know who within that 37%, socioeconomic, where they come from, and that?
Each school district gets the names, but for public distribution, obviously, the names are all removed, but each school district does, each school district can tell you, and perhaps there's a way at the state level where we could look at that more closely. I don't know the answer.
Well, I'm fine with scrubbing out the identities. I would just like to know where in the system we're seemingly failing. What school systems, so we don't have that yet.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
We just have the aggregate report.
Okay.
And I can check with others to find out what we can get.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious, in the slide on page 19, you talk about among the 25 to 34-year-olds, 48% have earned an associate degree, and 35 have earned a bachelor's. And we do know that Minnesota, if you look at I think it's Kale that does all the reports, Minnesota typically is high in any of these education rankings. But do you know if you put this 35% for 2008, and then backed it off for 40 years, what would you see? Would you see a constant increase in the number of students graduating from college? Do you see a great deal of fluctuation? What would a timeline look like?
Ms. Grimes?
Chair, Representative Norton, we're going to have to give you that. I'm sorry. I just don't have a sense of that off the top of my head. But I believe we can tell you, provide some information.
Okay, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a shadow with me today. I'd like to introduce a young lady from Pine Island, Minnesota, a student, a freshman at Pine Island. She's with the Family Career Community Leader of America. There's 30 students that are roaming the halls of the Capitol today that are from around the state of Minnesota. So just that's the young lady in red over there. So welcome.
Stand up.
I have a couple back here, too.
Welcome. Okay. Welcome.
I think that brings us to the end of our business with just one announcement that as chair, I'll be bringing forth a bill on Thursday dealing with the continuation of unallotments for higher education. So we'll be dealing with that on Thursday. No other business, we are adjourned.